Hi, this is Chris Thomas, and you're listening to Talk More Talk.
The whole, you know, origin of where we're all coming from.
I'm prepared for death because I don't believe in it. I think it's just getting out of one car and getting into another.
We're going to go ahead and get started. I've got things recording, so don't give away anything like personal information. Don't start reading off your bank details, okay? I know everybody wants to do that. We're very delighted to do our first in-person Talk More Talk. I know some of you are avid viewers of the show. None of my cats are here, so they won't be crawling around. They were not willing to make the trip because they're divas, one and all, and I apologize for that. But in any event, we're so thrilled that you're here with us for this special edition, and of course our guest is Chris Thomas. And when we're talking about Talk More Talk, well, that seemed redundant, but when we're talking about Talk More Talk, of course we're not just talking about the Beatles, but the solo Beatles. And we know we have some good questions. Apparently, Kit here has miles of them. So it's really just Kit and Chris today.
Yeah. No.
We have, of course, our usual folks are here. Tom Hamyadi. Hello, Tom.
How you doing?
Ken Michaels.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hi.
Looking good as all.
Yep.
My good pal, Kit O'Toole, the queen of all Beatles media. She is now stuck with that.
Yeah, stuck with it.
And, of course, Chris Thomas. And we're so delighted that you're here with us and have been with us all throughout the conference.
Thank you.
And as we've learned, Chris is not just a fount of information, but also just a really great person who's with a great personality who's fun to be around. And thank you for bringing that welcome element to our conference, because otherwise it would have just been, you know, cutthroat the whole time. So thank you very much. And Kit, kick it off.
Okay. Well, Chris, gosh, as you can see, I have a bunch of questions I'd love to ask you. But well, let's start at the beginning before we get to the solo
yes.
years. Now, you talked about this a little bit in your interview yesterday, but I'd love to hear more about it. You mentioned that Buddy Holly was an early influence on you. In what way?
It was the first music I fell in love with.
Mm-hmm. And how did it influence you as a producer, as a, you know?
I think one of the things that influenced me as a producer was, this is terrible. It's hard to remember. There's a song by Buddy Holly. I think it was Listen to Me, the guitar solo in it, and then it goes higher, and it's got an echo repeat on it, and this just sounded like it was going up into the heavens, and I just thought, wow, you know, I mean, like, the sound captivated me. So in the same way then that later on, hearing something like You've Lost That Loving Feeling, you know, what can you do with echo? I mean, it just transformed the entire world. I just fell in love with it. And the first time I heard anything like that that meant anything to me was Buddy Holly.
Wow. Yeah. And he was so ahead of his time, in terms of, composition.
Absolutely. And writing it and producing, doing everything himself, one man band.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, of course, you move on and you're working with the Beatles. And first, what was your reaction? I'd love to know this. When George Martin, you know, went on vacation and said, "You're on."
He didn't say I'm on.
Yeah, that's true.
He didn't. It was just like, carry on sitting at the back. Shut up. So, you know, that when it sort of, well, as I said, I was absolutely terrified when Paul said, like, well, you know, get on with it. And I say I don't think he was in a particularly, he was, wasn't very happy about whatever was going on that day. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that really threw me into it. Mm-hmm. With the added bonus that it probably meant he'd be able to throw me out. But I just, you know, I managed to get through it. And the reason I got through it was because at the end of the, you know, halfway through, I was really worried that this was going very badly because they completely ignored me. And I realised that if I didn't do something, if Paul, you know, if I wasn't going to be allowed in the next day and George found out about this, I probably wouldn't continue on, you know, with George. And that's what I needed. I needed this, you know, offer of staying there. But, you know, because that was like a home. This is a shelter. You know.
So everything. So how did you gain their trust? How did you go about, you know?
I don't know. I was just honest. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I just... did it absolutely. I mean, they'd obviously, I'd been in there for on and off for months and months, so they knew me, so I was a familiar face, just as all the tape ops and people like that were. And I was just honest. That's all you could do. And then, and I just, you didn't, there was no sort of thinking about it really. And as I say, the thing that sort of helped me in a way was in the end, I didn't care if it was the Beatles or anybody else, because what was more important was securing my employment with George Martin.
Yeah, so you had the best motivator.
That was it. That was it. You know, as I say, I was just straightforward, just honest from there. You know, and they knew that I loved the Beatles, and I, you know. So.
Yeah. All right. Want to pass on to.
Go ahead. I'd like to ask you, while you work for the Beatles, I mean, I know George Martin left and left you in charge for a short time. I think it was 2 weeks, was it?
Yeah.
What did you learn from George Martin later on, or the engineers that were there, like Ken Scott? Jeff Emmerich had already left. Mm. Did you ever work with Jeff?
No.
Okay.
No. I think after all that stuff, I did an audition, I think, for a band. Because one of the things I had to do when I was at Air was to try to find new talent. Mm-hmm. And so I did an audition at Abbey Road. And I think Ken was the engineer because, of course, he was assigned. I mean, it was, you know, a bit of a factory in there. And I remember saying, I said something about, he mentioned this in his book. I said, can you put, you know, sort of, what's the echo that you use on sort of Lennon's voice, meaning tape echo?
Right.
You know, these really early days. I didn't know anything technically. I was a musician. I was going there to work in a musical role.
Mm-hmm.
And he really took umbrage to that in his book. I just thought, very weird.
And George Martin, did you...
George, I mean, the main thing about George was... he worked in a very diplomatic kind of way. I think we're very different personalities. And I was more the sort of person that wanted to get involved much more directly in the music. Which, you know, that's the way I developed, you know, later on. I mean, that's rather than sort of sitting back and taking that overall view, I used to sort of dive into stuff.
Okay.
But I mean, the most important thing that George gave me in the world was this opportunity. I mean, like, and I'm just forever grateful for that, you know. And I made that very clear to him in the last sort of few years. We reconnected very well, and that was great.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about Helter Skelter, because you've all heard how the song changed dramatically.
Yeah. I'm not sure about this mythical one that lasts how long?
27 minutes is the myth.
Well, you can only last as long as a reel of tape.
Good point.
That's what I've always said.
It wasn't on the sessions when George was on holiday. Earlier on, it was like, tell us when the tape runs out. And they just, you know, and they were just jamming, basically.
Okay. Because we've all heard the story from Paul about how he heard Pete Townsend say that the Who were recording the loudest song ever.
Yeah.
And so at what point did he change Helter Skelter into what it became? Was it like in the middle of those two versions or what?
When we went to do it, it was like, it's okay, we're doing Helter Skelter, and it was like just straightforward, really.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was going to be the way it was going to be. You know, he sort of assembled it in his head. I don't remember any particular discussion about it. But at the same time, remember, I mean, I'm suddenly thrown into this situation where they're talking to Ken Scott, they're ignoring me, and I just don't know what's going on in the world. I think I'd have
I only bring this up because there was a dramatic change between both versions there.
Mm-hmm. What, do you mean in the sense that the original one was very, very slow and heavy?
Slow, mm-hmm. yeah. It's yeah. certainly gritty and gutsy and everything, yeah. but when it's faster like that, it has a whole
different... Yeah, but when they were doing it slow mm-hmm. that day, it was almost like, are they really trying to get a master here? It was very strange. The very fact that they end up saying, like, just tell us when the tape runs out. Mm-hmm. You could see that there was some other...
It was more they're testing it out, maybe?
I don't know. I don't know what the motivation mm-hmm. for that was. Well, apart from the fact that, like, what they were smoking...
yeah, yeah which, that's which a is, factor. Yeah,
and you can hear that on a lot of those. I mean, I noticed that on a lot of those outtakes. Like, you can hear they're just laughing around and they're goofing off, you know, and as well as working very hard. So there's always this sort of mixture of stuff going on.
Okay, I just want to bring up Piggies for a yeah. moment, because at what point was it decided we need a harpsichord here?
That was me. I just went into number one. I was looking for, you know, just things to sort of come up with ideas. Uh-huh. I wandered into number one and I saw a harpsichord. I absolutely adore harpsichords. I sort of sat down and went, oh, this is great. And I said to George, I said, why don't we get a harpsichord on it? And I said to, and he said, oh, yeah, okay. And I think it was John Smith who was the tape artist. I said, come on, we started to wheel it into number two. Ken right. Scott got wind of this and went absolutely nuts, because they could have been sort of almost about to do another take of you know, the first movement of a sonata, and then have to edit between it. So, you know what I mean? When they started again the next morning, that's why Ken went nuts. So we put it all back, and we moved the session into number one. And then we were sitting around, and you know, George and I were sitting around at the harpsichord, and he suddenly, that's when he just started playing this other song, which was just amazing. And I said, like, well, that's fantastic. We've got to do that instead. The song he was playing was Something.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And he said, do you really think? I said, it's fantastic. I said, we've got to do that. He said, oh, do you think it's really good? I said, yeah. He said, I'll give it to Jackie Lomax for a single.
Wow.
And he was insistent that we did Piggies. And then he said, you can play better than me, so you play it. And so I started playing on the backing track, and I couldn't keep time with him. It was really difficult. It was just that boom. I wasn't a good keyboard player. I hadn't practiced, I hadn't played for years, mm-hmm. you know, so it was pretty ropey. So they overdubbed me.
Wow, that was perfect what you added to it. But what gave you the feeling to have, obviously it's a harpsichord, but such a classical overtone to that? And how did George react to that?
Well, they said play a solo. So I sort of wrote a solo, and I'd written a little kind of Bach-inspired thing when I was a kid, which I called the Minute Sonata after the Minute Waltz, in the sense it did actually last a minute with the first and second and third movement, and did a little. So it was, that's why I was sort of used to fiddling around playing.
Well, and I think we've just heard some of the box set, the White Album set, but I think your harpsichord with that remix comes out beautifully. I mean, it really mm-hmm. just jumps out of the mix. Mm-hmm. Are you pleased with the way it turned out, you know, this remix?
The remix? I'm in two minds about this remixing mm-hmm. business. I mean... Yeah. When I found out this was happening, and I thought, oh my God, if they come near me, I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole personally, if I'd been offered it, and that's okay. a fact. I can't see the point, because it's, the one point I do see, and I think it is good, is that, as I said before, when I heard Strawberry Fields, that was the most incredible record ever, and about, not very long ago, only about 15, 20 years ago, I managed to track down a cassette which had about five different versions. This is before Anthology, so it's about dates actually when it was. And I just wanted to hear how on earth this thing mm-hmm. sort of came about, yeah. you know. And then you can hear ideas coming in, ideas being thrown out, you know, the whole bit. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that you can hear, because of the remix, it's like looking at it from the other side. It's like listening to something that you walk around there and you hear mm-hmm. it from over there, so it just sounds different, so you can hear different bits in it. But for me, what it destroys is the original image, and the original mm-hmm. image is always on the mono version. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, because that's the way that they played. So there would be percussion put on a song, for instance, because maybe in the mix down, they lost a little bit when they did the 4-4. You know the you know the way they work, the technical aspect of 4-4.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know they you would that 4-4 that would lock a relationship in of certain instruments. Mm-hmm. So then, as I say, occasionally you might put something on, or the way that you did the next overdub was relative to the way that was mixed, not just to the instruments that were there. Mm-hmm. So when you start taking everything out and trying to remix it and put it together without that sort of, I mean, the reason why, you know, if they mixed four tracks down to one, if they mixed four tracks down to one and recompressed it and put a bit of an echo on everything, which meant that that was going to have echo on echo later on, there was a reason for it. Mm-hmm. And to sort of take all the ingredients out of the cake and start to rebake it, I just find it's a little bit strange. And they were fastidious about these mono mixes. You know, this was the finished painting. That's why sometimes stereo mixes were farmed out.
Interesting. Yeah.
So when we, just to play with this idea for a moment, and this may be a situation you already have been approached about or will be with, so let's flash forward 11 years to Back to the Egg, right? Mm-hmm. And presumably we'll see that in the McCartney series sooner rather than later.
I hope so. Probably.
Is there value in approaching it from that point of view?
I don't know if there's value in any of that. I mean, I heard some of the Pepper stuff, and it was like, yeah, but. You know, the vocals are sort of very loud and very clear. Yeah, but. The point is, and as I said the other day, one of the things that Paul used to say to Jeff Emery, and always used to say, he was saying, Back to the Egg, said to the engineer, can you make it sound like a record? Which means just, you know, you're smashing it all down and it becomes sort of, you can't budge it from there, you know. You can't move it.
I guess it's analogous to what our artistic or authorial intentionality. When a writer writes a book and they finish it and, you know, sign off and it's published and assuming, you know, it's not chock full of errors, which they so often are, but right, it's published, that's their vision. That's their stereo, their mono or stereo picture.
Yeah.
And so that's where you start to have your...
That's where I'm at with it, definitely. Okay. Yeah. Definitely. And certainly when I went home, when it came out, I didn't listen. Obviously, I didn't listen to it in stereo. I listened to the mono.
Okay.
Sure.
Tom, how about
you? These last 2 days have been absolutely amazing listening to you tell all these stories and working for. My favorite song on the White Album that you touched on a little bit yesterday, like to add, see if you can add a little bit more to it. Happiness is a Warm Gun. Mm. I just love the three segments of the song. The song is brilliant, in my opinion. Mm. Yeah. You know, can you talk about how John presented it in the studio? Was it initially just three songs that he wanted, you know, help to forge together? Because I know it was a real band unity on this song.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk a little bit about Happiness is a Warm Gun, please.
Really, what happened, the thing about Happiness was, you know, it took pretty well 2 days to get the backing track.
Okay.
And the reason for that was because they were having to learn all these time changes and perform this as a song.
Right.
And, you know, you can hear how complicated it is. Apart from the normal complications of finding out which part people are going to play, the fact that you had all that stuff going on as well, and it just took a heck of a long time to chisel away to get there. And it finished up with some really good performances, and it turned out that the first part of one take was edited onto the second part of another take, and that's how the backing track was done. It took a long time, and it was just basically them out there playing it and getting it better and better and better. Real hard work. They had this real sense of purpose. It was fantastic. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Working with, I mean, obviously you performed on three George Harrison songs. Mm-hmm. He seemed like he was, I
well,
mean,
on
every,
the mic.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah. It seemed like he was, his confidence was growing, you know, year after year after year. I mean, can you talk about, you know, working with George closely? I mean, was he frustrated, you know, by, you know, what the input that he was able to put out on albums?
He was frustrated, and I think he laid the blame a bit at George Martin's door.
Okay.
I did feel that. I must be honest. So, I mean, I sort of ended up on the White Album working with him sort of more than anybody else.
Right.
You know. And then later on, when I did the solo stuff, the only stuff... I didn't know I played on three. I played on Isn't It a Pity. I did two. There were two tracks we did that day.
Okay.
And then at another occasion, I went to Trident, and that's when he'd been doing all these vocals for My Sweet Lord, and I sort of heard this huge sort of choir of... Right. I mean, hearing something like that in the studio, when you hear them isolated, it's like, yeah, it's incredible. But when I did... He had a Moog synthesizer, and I persuaded George Martin to buy one. And this thing arrived, and we looked for the sort of instruction manual, you know, where's the on switch and everything else. There was nothing, there was a blueprint.
Wow.
That's all there was, a blueprint.
Right.
And George basically said, well, good luck, Chris. That was it. He lost interest immediately.
Right.
And I was very lucky, because then we knew Mike Vickers, who used to be in Manfred Mann, because he was the one that programmed George Harrison's Moog for things like Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Ooh.
And he gave me lessons, so that's how I learned.
Oh, wow.
So I was booked to bring our Moog into number three, where George was doing a session. And Phil and George ran the song. They gave me a chord chart. And I said, what do you want? They said, play arpeggios. So I played arpeggios, and I said, what sound? They said, like, anything you like, you know, just a bit like a whatever, you know, nothing specific, which seemed a bit loose when you had, I mean, as against sort of Bungalow Bill, what do you want to play? Play what you like.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Suddenly we got, I mean, any sound on the planet, just do anything you like, seemed a bit too vague. And then I realized why, because there are quite a few people in the studio. Badfinger were there. Three of them were playing acoustics, and Mike Gibbons was playing tambourine along with Mal Evans. Alan White was playing drums. There were some session guitarists, just regular session guitarists there. I think there's a session, I can't remember who, there's a pianist there, I think. And we started running it down with George, I think, behind me, playing acoustic and singing. And we're sort of running it down, and all of a sudden sort of Billy Preston walked in and sat down at the organ.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of minutes later, Ringo walked in and sat down on a second set of drums.
Right.
And then Eric Clapton turns up. I'm going, what is going on? So many stars arriving, you know.
Right.
And this sort of orchestra sort of suddenly started, this right. huge band sort of developed.
I mean, I would imagine.
But that's why it probably didn't matter, you know, any old stuff, because it was just going to be mixed in. It's just an extra texture.
Right. I mean, I would imagine from your working with him on the White Album, then on All Things Must Pass, I mean, I would imagine that by the time you get to All Things Was Past, I mean, he must feel like a weight was lifted off his shoulders. I would imagine that now he's free to do whatever he wanted, and this was his time to really, you know, shine as an artist.
Yeah, but I mean, that was just, I think if anybody's making a record, then they're in there just to do the best thing they can. So, I mean, obviously it was a very important thing for him, you know, mm-hmm. tremendously, because it was the first thing, you know, yeah. since the Beatles. So... It was a chance also, as you said, it's a chance for him to actually say, oh, you've been missing out. You know,
right.
This is what I can do.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we'll move on to the solo years in just a second, but I wanted to ask you, so you've had, you know, we're now at the end of the 60s, you've had this experience producing the tracks on the White Album, working with them, so now you're ready to, you know, move on and establish your own career. What did you learn from your time with the Beatles as to what a producer does, and what is your vision of what a producer's role is?
Well, it was very hard because I didn't really know. I mean, they welcomed me. That was really brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And I did what I was asked of, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a producer's role is to, if the record should be better at the end of the day as a result of your involvement.
Mm-hmm.
That's to put it into a kind of nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, I when I sort of went out on my own, when, you know, after the White Album, I was very conscious that I really didn't know anything at all. You know, in the sense that you just got to keep learning, and you never stop learning. Everything's a different version,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the other thing is I was loath to tell actually anybody that I had worked with the Beatles, because I could see that would be a really stupid career move. Really, you know, really dumb. So I knew that I had to actually go right back and just not pay any attention to that, mm-hmm. and just embark on a career and hope that I'd be okay. And actually, in fact, the George Harrison session was very important to me, because with that Moog synthesizer, I got to see a lot of different producers in action, which I wouldn't normally have done. Engineers do, but if I'm a producer, another producer's not going to let me see what he does. You know, that was the hardest thing. Suddenly, I was sort of cast out. You know, and it was either me on my own doing something, and then, as I say, and then asking somebody like Jeff Emmerich, could you put that kind of same tape, you know, that same echo on? And it's like, well, I'm not doing that. just absolutely isolated. It was very difficult. When I got the Moog, it gave me a chance to watch different people. Mm-hmm. And did some great stuff. Did Songs of Love and Hate, Leonard Cohen. Mm-hmm. But the most important one, apart from the fact that Spector was my absolute idol, when we did a take that afternoon, some of the people were allowed in the control room to listen to what was going on, and George allowed me to come in, and we played the track. It was just massive. It was just completely different to what was going on out there.
Wow.
It was absolutely extraordinary. And then at one point, George said, can we play this, you know, the track we did last night, which I think was Wawa. And this came on, and again, it was just this Himalayan sound.
Massive.
And George said to Phil, he said, like, can you lift up Eric's guitar? Mm-hmm. And Phil said, no. Mm. He said, lift Eric's guitar. I want to hear Eric's guitar. He said, I can't. He said, what do you mean I can't? Mm-hmm. He said, I've mixed everything down to stereo. Wow. It's like, what? Wow. He said, we've got an 8-track, or maybe it was a 16-track at that time. Yeah. And he mixed everything, and George went nuts. And Phil said, well, if you don't like it, get somebody else. You know, why am I here?
Wow.
And that made me realize, I thought, hang on a minute, it's no good. I've got to really go a little bit further now in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I've got to make more of an impression on a record in terms of coming up with more ideas, and I've got to stick with them, because that's the only way I'm going to test myself, and that's the only way I'm going to find out. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, it means that this sort of dream thing, I'm not the right man for the job. You know, it's not meant to be. I didn't want to sort of fake it.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. And so it gave me the courage to, you know, in a sense, I didn't think what I was doing was courageous anyway. It just gave me the belief that this is the way to go, and if I fail, I fail, and it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Well, it did matter, but I mean, it was the only way to go about doing it. And so that was incredibly motivating, seeing that, you know, seeing it in action.
Wow. Well, and we'll be getting to Back in the Egg, which all four of us are huge fans, and I'm sure many people in this room are huge fans of. So leading up to that, just a follow-up question. You know, one of your many great strengths as a producer, I think, is how you're able to work with an artist and bring their sound up to date, but not detract from what, you know, from their signature sound. Elton John being a great example of that with your work. So, how do you do that? How do you strike that balance? How do you help them do that?
Well, I don't think I'm very good at making things contemporary, actually.
You did.
Well, the queen of all Beatles media.
I don't know. It's that thing of, like, just follow your nose, trust yourself, and if people don't like it, I would certainly argue my case if I think I'm going in the right direction, but also prepared to sort of step down if everybody's, you know, against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I just think your work with Elton John, as I said, in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, I mean, I think you just did a wonderful job of keeping his style, but you made it sound contemporary to that time.
Well, I think what helps there is one of the things when I started working with him, one of the things I really sort of pushed for, I wanted to get the original band back. Mm-hmm. And so when we did Too Low for Zero, we had the original band. So it's the musicians make the sound more than anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's that thing about Muscle Shoals. And everybody went to Muscle Shoals expecting to make records to sound like that. And then the bands, all the musicians went up to New York, and it sounded like Muscle Shoals. It had nothing to do with the studio.
Right.
You know, and So it's the musicians that bring their own character, and you can hear that character. So on Elton's records, for instance, when they do backing vocals, when the three of them, mm-hmm. when Davey D and Nigel did backing vocals, you can't replace that with another voice. Mm-hmm. When we did I'm Still Standing, mm-hmm. Davey, who always used to take the lower part, was ill. Mm. And so Elton said, I'll take his part. Wow. And it sounded completely different. It did not work. Wow. End of. So we had to wait until he got better. But so in the meantime, mm-hmm. because Elton's such a fast, well, he came up with the Yeah 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 ideas, and we did mm-hmm. those with him.
Wow.
But for the sort of actual pads, it had to always be that you couldn't replace it. So very, you're working with certain colours, mm-hmm. you know.
Right. Wow. All right.
Okay. I just want to expand on what Kit just said, and mm-hmm. I really think that your work sounds very contemporary to me from decades ago.
Absolutely.
I can listen to The Pretenders right now, and it could have come out today.
Yep.
Really. Same thing with In Excess. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the sound of those records. Mm-hmm. I think you did a phenomenal job with those.
The Townsend albums. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But can we start on Back to the End?
Yeah.
Ken's ready. He's ready.
Oh, God, this is going to be a difficult one.
I want to start with the never-ending debate about the concept of Wings and whether or not it was a collaborative group. Because you always have people, especially on social media, saying that Wings was Paul and Sidemen working with him. Mm. And depending on who I've asked, and I've interviewed Denny Sywell, who said the exact opposite, it was a very collaborative effort between the group. Lawrence Juber has said the same thing. Lauren said to me if he had an idea on the guitar and he brought it to Paul and he liked it, he'd use it. Mm. From what you observed in the studio, do you think Wings was really a group effort, or was it Paul dictating to the musicians what he wanted?
It wasn't so much a question of dictating to the musicians. I mean, like, if you're putting a backing track down, then you learn your part and you play it.
Mm.
But then Paul would then, he was, without any question, the person in charge. You know, he would then take it from there.
Okay.
You know, so it was, I mean, I can't speak to what happened earlier on with Denny Sywell, but I'm Back to the Egg. I mean, that's the way it was done. I mean, you put a backing track down, and Paul knew what he wanted most of the time, you know. So it wasn't saying, I want you to play this and I want you to play that. He didn't do that. Because that first part is like, let's see what happens. You know, and then you start shaping it. So I think that's the thing I learned from him as well, as like in that kind of way of working.
Did you witness times when different members of Wings came up with an idea and Paul accepted it?
Oh gosh, that's a difficult one. That's a difficult one. I really can't remember of particular instances.
Just seems to
one
me
way or the other, really.
If you listen to something like Old Siamser, the drum sound from Steve Holly and what he added with his fills and everything sounded like his own contribution.
Oh, absolutely. But again, that's what I was saying, similar to what I was saying about, for instance, when working with Elton, the musicians bring their own personality. So, I mean, the drummer's free to, he's there as the drummer. So I can't remember Paul ever sort of saying, there might be a particular fill and a bit of a, you know, I mean, all these things are going on all the time. You know, so he might say, I don't like this and let's do that.
Right.
But effectively, you know, Steve plays he plays the drums and that's that, you know.
Okay.
I mean, that's how most bands work. I mean, again, using Elton as an analogy, I mean, you had to work so fast with him. About the second or third run through of a song with him used to be almost the take. So, you know, the drum, it was just like you're playing it and you're taking it. It was that quick. You had to be that on the ball. Now, obviously, then you go back to overdubbing stuff and working parts.
Right.
You know. And so then you might sort of replace a guitar part and do something else. And Back to the Egg did become very, very long and it did become laborious. So there was obviously a lot of that stuff going on. And a lot of it is kind of erased from my memory because it did go on for such a long time. In fact, I feel that it got to the point where we were making the album worse, not better, truthfully.
What do you do when you're in a situation like that and you're in the producer's chair and you can feel this tide turning like that? That has to be alarming.
I would think.
Very difficult, because to be really frank about Paul, I mean, you could see on the... you know, some of the film that we saw yesterday. I mean, Paul is very determined about what he wants, and he's right. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what makes him. He is the genius. You know, he is a genius. Yeah. You know, it's extraordinary. I mean, he doesn't just sort of work very quickly, but he works at this high level all the time. Mm-hmm. So he, I would say something sometimes, and normally it was pretty collaborative, but towards the end it wasn't. And it got to the point where he started wanting to introduce new songs, different things that he had done previously, basically when he'd done them on his own, and tried to sort of bring them into the record, which was pretty dispiriting, quite honestly, because it sort of meant that he'd sort of lost faith a little bit in what we were doing. And we had a studio, have you heard about Replica Studio? The studio, you know, the studio in the basement there.
MPL.
And and David Bowie came down one afternoon, and Paul started playing the tracks, and Bowie was effusive, and I thought, okay, you know, I love this, and, oh, this is fantastic, oh, this is like, and then all of a sudden Paul slips in one of these songs, and I thought, oh, what? And Bowie went, don't like that. I thought, oh my God, you know? And Bowie got, he got them all, he actually every single other one got flipped, and by the time, well, the next day we were back to the original album.
Wow.
Very interesting.
So,
were there times when you disagreed with the way Paul wanted things?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. I mean, that happens in every record, all the time. It can happen once a day with stuff. I mean, but that's it. You're bending it and shaping it as it goes on. That's all part of the conversation.
It must have helped that you've had all these years of a friendship with him where you could probably tell him what, how you
feel. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was really important.
Now, you mentioned Replica Studios. It was also recorded at Spirit of Ronicon.
Right.
Originally,
and also Limp Castle in Scotland.
Yeah.
Was that all done for inspiration, and how did you feel about working in so many different locations? Did that just slow the whole process down?
I don't think it slowed things down too much. It was just an interesting way of doing things, and it did give you different sort of angles on something. So I think it's a good way of not being stale. It just throws up new possibilities all the time. Yeah. So it forces you to work in a slightly different way. Yeah. So that was good.
It's interesting that you mention the Bowie story, which is very nice.
Yeah.
I'd mentioned Love Awake yesterday.
Yeah.
And you had, was it Pete Townsend?
Mm-hmm. No, Arrow Through Me.
Ah, it was Arrow Through Me, right.
Wow.
And how a visit could...
Well, yeah, here we are. This is a good one. We were in number 3 at Abbey Road, and Townsend, Pete was recording an orchestra. He's doing some orchestral session in number 1 for some project he was working on. And he came in to say hello to Paul. And this is before I was working with Pete. Because this was 78. I didn't work with Pete until a year later. Mm-hmm. Although I did know him. But that's irrelevant. Pete came up and had a listen. We played some stuff and played Arrow Through Me. And Pete was like, he said, that is amazing.
Yeah.
He said, it sounds incredible. He said, it's a stroke of genius not having any bass guitar on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point,
yeah.
He said, there's so much space. It sounded so fantastic. So, you know, that was that. Pete went away and Paul put bass on. And this song had been hanging around for months and months and months.
Wow.
In the form that it had been, that Pete said was absolutely brilliant, and we immediately put a bass on it. So it's just like, oh,
I thought the bass is on the keyboard.
No, he actually overdubbed a bass on it as well afterwards.
Mm, okay. Wow. Yep. Wow. Tom, you want?
Yeah, I'm just curious as to how you're involved with came to be for Back to the Egg. I mean, did you from the time of your last session with the Beatles up until the Back and Egg sessions came to be, I mean, did you still have a friendship with Paul?
How did he contact you
to help him out?
I saw him a few times here and there. And then when they did the Wings Over the World triple album, he sent it to me to have a listen to, and I made some comments on it. So you sort of wanted somebody to sort of another pair of ears to hear it. So I made some comments about it. And then they were going to make a film, Rock Show, from that tour. Yeah. And the problem with that, and that's what he, I was invited then to work on Rock Show. Okay. The problem with that is that it had been edited to picture, not to sound. So there were five concerts, I think, at Madison Square Gardens and Seattle and other places. And so when the edits went through, the sound went all over the place. So the producer of the films, that's when he said, well, we need somebody to come in and fix the sound. So that's how I came into it. And I said, well, you can't. You know, you've got to do edits that work correctly. And then you fit picture to the sound.
Right.
We had to do it upside down. So we effectively had to re-record a hell of a lot.
Wow.
A hell of a lot. Right. It was, yeah.
So from that, then.
So then that led to Back to the Egg. Yeah.
Gotcha. You know, Paul at this point really didn't work with another producer. He did have Glenn Johns come on board for Red Rose Speedway, but he left those sessions because of, you know, focus issues or too much substance issues. Or I mean, did you get that sense during the Back to the Egg sessions at time where, I mean, this was, I think you did say you did drag on for a year.
Yeah.
But I mean, at any point did you feel like, oh my God, I can't take this anymore. I got to get out of here.
Not quite, but when it was very strange because certainly once it got into, what was it, 79, I felt that I'd been sort of like taped up. I was like, I did start to feel very, very frustrated. Yeah. And when I came out of the sessions, when the record was finished, Chrissy Hind, who I knew well from a few years beforehand, she approached me about producing The Pretenders, and I said, I just don't want to go in the studio. I just don't want to go back in the studio. But so I had two completely conflicting things going on. I didn't want to go at the studio. At the same time, I felt so frustrated that in actual fact, once I went back, when I did go back to work, and the reason I went back to work was, first of all, I went to see the band, who were great. Secondly, she sent me a demo tape with four songs on it. Two of those songs were Private Lives and Brass in Pocket. Mm-hmm. And when I heard Brass in Pocket, the tempo wasn't right, but it sounded to me like an Al Green.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, if we get that sorted, I thought, that's a hit.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So that was the reason why I started to get involved with them. And then Townsend came, he asked me to make his record. So I was making two records at once. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing. I was sort of pulled back like a catapult, you know. Right. And then when I was released, I finally went bang.
No stopping. Some of the tracks that you enjoyed working on Back to the Egg?
I think I enjoyed working on all of them initially. Right. I just didn't like the fact that, when you labour at something, you know, you can almost hear the fatigue in the finished product, I think, you know, when it goes on and on and on. There was a freshness. A friend of mine who used to be an engineer at Air London, many years later, he found a bootleg of the Rannican stuff. And he said, it was so much better then. I went, there you go. And, you know, that was unsolicited. And he just said, and that's how I felt about it.
Well, I love the record. And I think maybe I'm thinking about it as 14-year-old me.
Yeah.
When I listened to it, it was played at midnight on the release date.
Oh, wow.
Yes, on Houston, Texas's Album Rock station. And I loved it, and I liked the quickening energy of the guitars on Getting Closer, for example.
Yeah. Oh, there's some great stuff.
Oh, there is, and Spin It On, and I liked Orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah.
The piece that really haunted me, and I previewed this with you the other day, was The Broadcast, you know, with the almost a kind of avant-garde experimental piece, but it seemed to fit inside the mix.
Yeah.
There was a natural flow. Let's see, it was... Yeah, it went from Winter Rose, Love Awake, the two pairs of medleys, and then it went to So Glad to See You Here, and there was a nice fluidity what was it like recording the broadcast? What? How does that even come up? I mean, it, and of course, future English major me also liked the fact that it had poetry in it, right?
Well, first of all, I haven't heard it since 1979.
Well, let me fix that for you. and actually, this will be good for our friends here.
We've got a chance, and we'll
Oh, it's fantastic.
We may even have to cut and run for it. Well, it won't be the first time I've run, and it won't be the first time I've
I can't even remember the strings or anything. I just, it's gone. It's like Ken Scott saying what it was like with Eric Clapton and while my guitar gently weeps, and I can't remember him coming into the studio. And he engineered it.
I immediately, and it was after midnight, so I was breaking several rules as 14-year-old me when I was listening to it. I was starting to nod off, not because of the production, because I was just tired. And it kind of jerked me awake, and I thought, well, this is different.
Yeah. To be quite honest, I think the reason why I've got a kind of jaundiced sort of view of it is that I was just so tired out by the thing by the time it finished that I don't, you know, as I said, from 78 onwards, I felt really, you know, and I was involved. I mean, like, they didn't, you know, I was still given complete involvement in everything. I was just tired out by it. And that's the reason, so I can, you know, that's the reason I just don't feel sort of that fond of it. I'm sure if I listen to it again, I might sort of suddenly go like, I mean, as soon as I heard that, I thought, that's fantastic.
Well, and he told me, Chris here, the other day that he has two reactions to when you hear your music years later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's one or the other. It's either like I just bury my head in shame. I just cannot believe how horrible the mix I've done is. That's normally the first thing. The mix is atrocious.
Not this time, though.
Or I hear something that I've done. I thought, how the hell? It's so good. It's so perfect. I can't conceive how I managed to do it in the first place. And I go, I better give up now because I can't possibly do anything like that again. Mm-hmm. So it's a total extreme sort of reaction to all of it.
Queen?
Before we move on, I just want to mention that the reason I brought up about Elton John and your sound is that, you know, one of the things I love about Back to the Egg is the sheer variety of sounds on it, and one of them is, you know, that he was tapping into punk and new wave. I mean, you know, at the time, and
that's what Old Siam was definitely.
You know, and even Spin It On. I mean, you know, and you go from that to Baby's Request. I mean, it's you know, it's just amazing. But yeah, that's what I was sort of getting at is, okay, so Paul says to you, I want to, you know, experiment with what's going on right now, punk and new wave. Mm. How do you, you know, work with him on that to say, okay, we, you know, we want him to sound contemporary, and, you know, if he wants to explore that, but not sound, you know, because it never goes over the top. I mean, it sounds convincing.
Yes.
You know.
Mm-hmm. I think the whole ethos, I never bought the whole ethos of punk particularly, other than the fact that the good thing that came out of it was, like, if you couldn't play, you could join a band. So it gave you a starting point. It wasn't sort of like this thing that was that become out of sight. So it returned it sort of back to sort of to just ordinary kids, which was great. But the most important thing that happened was it really went back to sort of rock and roll roots. If you listen to the Sex Pistols, I mean, it's all sort of like, it's just Chuck Berry stuff and, you know, And I think the same thing happened with Old Siam. I mean, it's Paul rocking out, you know, probably the great. I mean, wow, what a rock and roll singer! I mean, it's just listening to Helter Skelter yesterday. You just go, what?
Yeah, really.
Human being did the same. I mean, it's just incredible, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, the same man that sang "I Will," you know, goes from "I Will" to Helter Skelter. Amazing. Yeah.
And didn't he do "I'm Down" and Eleanor Rigby the same day?
It was "I'm Down, I've Just Seen a Face" and "Yesterday."
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, "Yesterday." Yeah. Yes,
I mean, I just taught it.
Yeah. Oh, well, there he goes.
Well, you have to show the students the magic of, I mean, you know, this is a single day.
Well, and this is a genius. This is the point. Yeah. You know? So,
Tom, did you thought?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought you were going to say something. All right. So before we get to Run, Double Run, you're all going to have to indulge me for a moment. I really want
to
ask this.
Yeah,
no. No, this is a completely selfish question, because to meet the person who recorded Face to Face, that is one of my favorite Pete Townsend tracks. Really? I love it. I remember it from, you know, I think I was in like eighth grade or something when I first heard it. So, and I still crank it on my iPod. Yeah. But it's an example of what I love about a lot of your productions, like with NXS, as Ken was mentioning earlier, that hard-hitting sound that you got. How did you do that?
Well, face-to-face was, for me personally, I don't think I've even spoken to Pete about this, because I was worried. I wouldn't have said where it came from, because he might have rejected the idea. But I got it from Let's Go Crazy.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which is the most incredible opening sequence of any film ever.
Yes.
And so I got that.
Nice.
I got that whole idea. And Simon Phillips, who is the most extraordinary drummer, I asked him to play, because I'm pretty sure the bass drum was a sample and running through it. I asked, and I didn't want a sampled snare, because I didn't want it to sound the same. I didn't want it to sound like a beatbox. I wanted it to sound like drums. And so I asked Simon, and he's one of the few people on the planet that would be able to do it. I said, I just want to go, da, da.
Here it is real quick.
Yeah, so, you've got to hear this.
You've got to probably pretend you're playing the bass drum in order to synchronize yourself.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And he actually did it.
Yeah, listen to this.
Yeah. And then you bring it up, right? But we get the idea.
So that's where I got the idea from.
Wow.
But then you needed somebody like, you know, and obviously Prince didn't do it like that. I mean, right. God knows how he did it or what he did it, but that's the influence I took.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I had somebody as good as Simon to be able to do it.
Wow, and I hear it now. I hear the Prince influence, definitely. Yeah. So thank you. I wanted to ask you about that. All right, let's move on then to Run Devil Run.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm so sorry. Yeah, of course.
I wanted to ask what it was like to record Rock Astra. You had
that
so
was
many.
Oh yeah, of course.
There.
Thank you.
All
Ken,
piled
yes.
into one studio.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you? How many tracks were there on the mixing board? I can't remember.
I think we mixed it into sort of sections, so it's like keyboards, guitars, that kind of thing.
Was it very complicated?
Well, the idea was to make it simple, so that there was no sort of, you know, everybody stuck to the script. Otherwise, it would be completely, be like a Charlie Mingus record gone mad. And so, you know, the guitars played their part. And John Paul Jones was playing piano as well as Gary Brooker. And John Paul Jones was playing lots of sort of extra sort of stuff. And I went down there and I said, and I meant it as sort of tongue in cheek, I said, no jazz, right?
Yeah.
And so later on in the evening, once it was all finished, I sort of bumped into him. I said, do you enjoy it? And he said, yeah, until he said no jazz and walked off. But it was fantastic. I mean, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. And it's so weird because the gestation of that is, Paul and I both had the same ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about my idea of, because I had, it's quite, well, it's a bit of a long one. Maybe we should skip on and go on to something else. But,
I don't mind, but
the point is, I had this idea in the same way that in sort of a big band, you get all the saxes suddenly stand up and play sort of the bit. You know, I thought, wouldn't it be great nowadays? I specifically thought of something that I did on the Badfinger album, Wish You Were Here, where there's a guitar solo and it's six guitars, and there's six comb and paper, you know, like kazoos. I thought, wouldn't it be great to do this live and have six guitarists and six blokes on kazoos or camera paper doing the solo, but then like and two drummers and this, that, and everything else, and just do it as a gig like that.
Right.
And Paul said, like, oh, I thought of that as well. He said, except I've got a name for it. I said, what's that? He said, Rockestra. Mm-hmm. Bingo. So we went out and did it. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. All great. Right. Well, glad you asked that, because that is an incredible, incredible record. And it's not like, I mean, you had a lot to direct. I mean, there was a lot of people involved, and it, you know, but it never becomes chaotic. I mean,
it had to be structured. That's the point.
Exactly. Okay,
it had to be done like an orchestra. In a sense, like the first violins do this, the second violins do that, and anything else, just like I say, it becomes.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. All right, let's move on to Run Devil Run.
Yeah.
I was talking about hard-hitting records like Face to Face and In Excess on, and in a way that applies to Run Devil Run, although, you know, in a different sense. So take us into the recording of that. You know, Paul was in a, you know, particular place then, you know, when it passed, and you know, this was kind of his first record after. So what was the mood like in the, you know, what was it like in the studio?
Well, the mood was okay. I think for Paul it was very much a cathartic record. I mean, it was unquestionably almost done as a cathartic
album.
You
must have felt that too, though.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
You were very fond of Linda.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like, this is for Linda album. You know, well, definitely. But I certainly thought that, you know, and I'm sure he did as well. Mm-hmm.
You kind of answered it, but because it does sound like a catharsis when you listen to it. So what was Paul's intention? I mean,
I think it was just that. I think it was that. I mean, for me, the attraction of doing the record was it. We discussed it, and it's like, it's going to take a couple of days. I mean, great. Mm-hmm. I'm on. Well, you know, I don't want to do like a couple of years. And the other thing that was fantastic about that is he came in, he got the Hofner out, and he sang live.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I mean, there aren't many people that can sort of turn that stuff out. Mm-hmm. And it really, and it made me laugh in a way, because it reminded me that when Abbey Road was starting off, George was away again, and we were doing Oh Darling, and he did this thing where he was really roughing his voice up.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, and I didn't like it because it didn't sound like him, and he was the greatest white rock and roll singer on the bloody planet. I said, come on, and I actually said, you sang I'm Down, you know. Right. And he said, I can't sing like that anymore. You know, I'm older now, and I thought that was a bit of a cop-out. You know, it was only a couple of years or something. And sure enough, like 20, 30 years later, we go in and did, you know, and he's singing like that. I mean, it's absolutely thrilling. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, his voice is just incredible on that record. Yeah. I mean, it just sounds like a renewed energy. So that, I mean, because that was what I was going to ask you is, you know, how do you bring that out? But it sounds like
you don't have to bring it out.
Yeah,
that's him.
It was him.
It's a question of you just record it.
Yeah. Wow. And what was one of some of your favorite tracks from the album to work on?
I can't remember now. I mean,
okay.
Virtually anything. Well, I think there might have even been some songs that we did that weren't on there. I'm pretty sure there were. But there was one really interesting one that I felt we could have got a bit more out of if it had been a normal album.
Mm-hmm.
And I Got Stung, which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
No Other Baby.
Yeah.
And I really wanted it. I didn't quite get... I know what I was going for. I was almost going for that sort of... The thing that you got in Twin Peaks, that haunting guitar thing.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing is that the thing that was difficult with that song is the structure of the actual verse, and it's very long.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to sort of somehow have it so, you know, you've got a verse with the guitar playing it, and then a verse with a vocal, and then and then a verse with the guitar. And it just didn't, I didn't quite get what I was going for on that.
Mm.
A bit frustrated. Because I could see that being really monstrous. I thought that could have been really fantastic. And I couldn't work out. I didn't solve the problem, in other words.
Well, it sounded great to us.
So that's good. But I had a higher...
Wonderful.
I had a higher goal for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I didn't... And maybe if we'd worked on it for longer, I might have been able to crack the code to find out what it was, where you swap this bit for that bit somehow.
Wow.
Yeah, I just, and so every now and again I've sort of thought I should go back and reinvestigate it and see if I, because it's like sort of solving, it's solving a puzzle, and it's just, you know, that there's a way there somewhere, and then it will be fantastic.
Yeah, you know. Right. Hmm. Guys, what do you?
Well, I want to just apply something, well, it could also bring back to the egg into the fold here, but because I associate you so much with Helter Skelter, it just seems to me like whenever Paul wants to really rock out or have an edge, call Chris Thomas. I mean, when you think about all the different producers that he's asked to work with in his solo career, he picked you for Run Devil Run. Was there a thought of, let's really make this edgy and rock out? Because to me, there's a huge difference between Run Devil Run and the Russian album, which I always associate since they're both covers. The Russian album is very loose and almost, I mean, they're great recordings to themselves, but they're almost like a rehearsal to some degree, whereas Run Devil Run's very tight.
It just sounds
like the band rehearsed all the songs, they went into the studio, and in a few takes, they were done.
Well, they didn't rehearse much. No, definitely not. They're just a great band. Yeah. Although there was a bit of tension there because Gilmour didn't like Ian Paice as a drummer.
Wow. Really?
In fact, he
really?
Persuaded Paul to get Dave Mattox in.
Right.
And we tried something, and I think Dave Mattox is on one of the tracks, and he was so on, he was so so perfect, it just sounded sterile. And so, you know, the fact that, I mean, the reason I wanted, because that was my choice to get Ian Paice in, and I wanted him there because I knew it wouldn't, I knew it was going to sound, you know, a bit mad. You need the drummer to be a bit mad. You know, otherwise you can just use a box to do it for you. And I don't mean this against Dave Mattox, but he was absolutely, you know, spot on. And that's why when I worked with Simon Phillips, he was a bit like that. I actually tried to get him to be a bit more, you know, to rock out a bit more.
Gotcha.
And I think possibly what used to happen, Linda was a big, you know, a big voice in Paul's ear. And Linda always, she was, you know, I think a big fan of mine. So it was like, well, get Chris. And, you know, so I think there could well have been a possibility of that happening. And Paul mentioned something about the girls, the daughters, saying something about how their mum thought about me. In terms of the work. So that's I think why he asked me to do, you know, out of nowhere, asked me to do Run Devil Run. I think there was that definite connection.
Could it be also from all your other work? Maybe they were familiar with.
Yeah.
Pretender is an excellent.
I mean, it's really hard for me to say how other people view my stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I can't really. I shouldn't have embarked on trying to answer the question.
It's also ironic that you have Dave Gilmour and Back to the Egg and
Mick Green, who was a revelation. I didn't know Mick before that, and he's absolutely bloody fantastic. The only time I remember seeing anything was a film of the Pirates from about 1976, and he's just so amazing. He was such a great guitarist, really, you know. And then he became a really good friend, actually, after those sessions, became a really good friend.
Yeah, you see that band, especially at Live at the Cavern.
You
kind of wish, wow, take this band on the road.
Absolutely. I mean, super group.
Tom, you want to?
I mean, I know we're running a little bit short on time here, but if you don't mind, can I ask, do like a little fact or fiction thing? I read that you mixed songs for a possible Cold Cuts release. Is that...
We tried working on some of that stuff,
okay. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Things like, I think, Water...
Watersprout?
No, not Water... Was it
Waterfall?
Waterspout.
Waterspout was from the London Town Sessions. That was supposed to be on Cold Cuts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there was the same time next year, too, I think, that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Well, that was one that he was doing, that was during Back to the Egg.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I did bits of, we did work on some stuff. It wasn't Waterfall. I can't remember the song.
It wasn't Rain Clouds, was it?
No, it was the one with the sample on it.
Well, here are all the songs.
Cage or Robber's Ball.
It sounds like
Water Spout.
Yes.
All right, cool. Ken? Well, yeah, in keeping with our practice, since we don't have cats here, we do have a great audience. and by the way, they could be listening. Cats are also a great audience. They're the best audience. But having said that, we always take questions online from our viewers, and we have one online question that the Queen will share, and then we're going to move to I'm making that stick.
Yeah,
and then
you
we're
are.
Going
Good
to
Lord.
Open it up here. We still have about 11 minutes.
Yep. So. All right. Let me throw out the reader submitted question, our viewer submitted question first, and then we'll open it up. The viewer wrote, your work with Bill Price on the Sex Pistols album is astonishing. Could you discuss the process for folks unaware of how great that production is on that record, please?
This is a bit of a long one. okay, when we did Anarchy, that was with Glenn in the band, and we had to sort of edit the backing track together for that. That was quite difficult doing that backing track, I think. Nothing against Glenn. Then we went in to the studio on Boxing Day of 76. Glenn had been fired from the band and was invited in as a session musician, so Glenn didn't turn up. Worked with, so I had to do it with Steve and Paul. Now, every bit of downtime, this is going to be quite a long answer.
Okay.
Every bit of downtime, Steve and Paul, where the gear was set up outside, they run through their set, which was about 30 minutes long. So they just played this. This was like just like rolling out, you know, it's like playing it like a machine. It was just like right all the time. So we went in to cut the first track, whichever one it was, of which out of those four, we did EMI, No Future, Pretty Vacant. And you didn't know if it, I mean, it's like it sounded perfect, but you can't really tell with just a guitar and drums. It's so odd. So I said to Steve, I said, can you try putting some bass on? Because I really don't know where we're going with this at all. Mm-hmm. And I said to Bill, I said, record everything that he does, because then maybe he'll do a few little ideas. Mm-hmm. We can start stitching them together and work out a part. Mm-hmm. Steve went out there and played exactly what he played on the guitar, on the bass guitar, an octave below.
Wow.
And it was just like, bang, that's it. Yeah. That's what it is. Now, the other thing that happened was that I was never a fan of stereo, as I pointed out earlier on. But I wanted to utilize it to the best effect, and so I came up, my idea was mono deluxe. Mm-hmm. So if it comes out the left, it comes out the right, and in addition to that, stuff comes out in the middle.
Right.
So once we put the bass down, Steve's guitar would be on the left. I'd get him to double track it, and then we'd harmonize one of the tracks so that we actually ended up with, I think normally we'd have a guitar on the left, the double track maybe on the right, and the harmonizer in the middle. It depended. But that was the template for everything. Mm-hmm. And I've never made a record before which has had a template and it's stuck to, and that's that. You know, so everything was like drums, bass guitar, three guitars, and then the whatever overdubs and whatever you want to do, and that was everything. So that's why it ended up well. There's the original credit, and I haven't got time to explain about why it was, because it was my way of having a dig at journalists. Was produced by Chris Thomas or Bill Price, because I wasn't there for some of the tracks, because I didn't need to be. There's a silly thing out there on the internet that says that Malcolm hired me for the singles and Bill for the album. That's rubbish.
That's not true.
Otherwise, why was I there doing the last track, Bodies, from start? Yeah, and that's when we really got to our sort of apogee doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really felt we were really cracking something, you know.
Right.
We really established a sound, and it was going in a direction. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
All right.
Kevin.
Yeah.
Couple things. One was just sort of a point. Actually, I talked to Steve Holly, because Arrow 3 is like might be like my favorite solo song. And he actually told me that McCartney wrote the drums for that. And
he did.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Oh, well, fair enough then. There you go.
But then it was played back. I guess the track was slowed down, and he played to a slower.
Oh, I can't remember. all these things are days at the office. I mean, I'm actually amazed I remembered this stuff.
And how many songs have the spoons on them, right?
Yeah, right.
But I was wondering, there's, you know, sort of this legendary story about the Beatles during the recording of Helter Skelter just being out of their minds, and George running around with an ashtray.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you can tell a little bit about the recording and what you saw.
Well, they were just stoned, they were larking around. I mean, like, Mal and John were playing trumpet and saxophone, because they're both brilliant exponents of these two instruments. George is just sort of set fire to the ashtray and just like running around. They're just larking around, because they were captive in that studio. You know, they lived in the studio, they had their arguments in the studio. If they had any arguments, they had to discuss Beatles, you know, they discussed business, and their downtime was in the studio. And so their downtime was when they were playing and larking around, and then they were, so sometimes they're larking around when they're actually playing, sometimes they're serious about getting the tape. You know, actually Spoon's Souvenir London, Procol Harum, many years before.
Oh, right. Mm.
Played by two roadies, and neither of them could play spoons, so one did one and one did the other one. And that's how you make records.
Punch is right behind here.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about your work with Badfinger. Badfinger, okay, one of the great successes of Apple, and McCartney and Harrison were directly invested in that band in different ways.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about what your memories are working with them, what most vivid memories, whether it was the people in the band themselves or certain tracks, and were McCartney and Harrison in that orbit? Were they still monitoring what they were doing?
They were, first of all, when I came in, I started working with them to finish off Ass, which was their last record on Apple.
Mm-hmm.
So then after that, they were on Warner Brothers. And they had a lot of problems with their management, and it's one of the greatest tragedies on the planet. You look at what happened to two of them. I mean, enough said.
Right.
So that will give you some idea of the shadow that was there all the time. When we came to do Wish You Were Here, we went up to Caribou, and they were saying, like, well, it was more like, why are we here? Because they said, well, you know, why aren't we just out for, you know, promoting the last album? And they were extremely despondent. Plus, they hadn't had time to write anything. And I said, well, the only way around this is somehow we've just got to make the best record. Because they felt that they'd been ignored by the record company on the previous album. I said, we've got to make the best album. You've got to make the best album in the world, and if you make the best album in the world, it's going to sell anyway, regardless of anything, because people are going to hear it and they're going to love it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the sort of weird sort of, you know, like the sort of general going into sending them over, you know, to get their heads blown up. And so that's the sort of attitude that we sort of did. So out of the scraps of songs, that's how I nicked Paul's idea from Abbey Road, and the two long songs on Wish You Were Here, I basically chopped bits together. I chopped bits together in my head in terms of forming it into a song or a long piece of music. So that's why you've got like a couple of 6-minute things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got them to play it. The same, and that's probably influenced by Happiness. You know, it's like, right, now you've got to play it. And I remember Mike Gibbons.
Yep.
There's one track, I can't remember what it was, but Mike Gibbons was about to kill me at the end of it. You know, it really was. But he was happier many years later when he heard it.
I bet.
Revisited it. Yeah.
You know, there's such a great moment for Badfinger with the very popular, critically acclaimed Breaking Bad series when they were the closing track with Baby Blue. It was nice. I love it when our culture does that, right? Occasionally.
Yeah.
Something will come back and it reminds us of this artifact and how great they were.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
I was going to say, the flip side of that is the last track in bringing back that Journey song.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
Exactly. My question, Chris, is pertaining to, again, with Paul on drums. Can we dispel this notion, if you recall, see what other people in the room? That's Paul at the end of Dear Prudence, right? Not is Ringo it? Overdubbing.
I wasn't there. I wasn't there for Dear Prudence.
Well,
I'm pretty sure it's Paul played drums on Ballad of John and Yosho. I think that's
sure.
Just the
On Dear Prudence, and there's a rumor, I personally don't subscribe to it, but I'm not.
Don't know, because I wasn't there.
Ringo overdubbed the end section.
Yeah.
Okay.
And sorry.
someone's going to...
It's going to remain a mystery.
Right.
Ken Scott. We could ask Paul or
Ken
Ringo,
Scott,
but they might not remember.
Ken Scott might remember, but as I say, he didn't remember Eric playing the guitar.
Right.
I thought he was going to go to the old Siamser instrument switching question.
What's that?
I thought you were going to go there too, Tom. Fact or fiction that Wings switched instrumentation on that track.
Oh, from the video?
Yeah. Which I've never bought into.
Mm.
It has quite an internet life.
Oh, I can't remember.
Well, that's
you know, you do try. No, because the thing is, sometimes you just try a sort of crazy idea, and it sticks, so you move on to the next thing, and then it's sort of like so many years later, somebody says, do you remember that? And you go, no. I mean, somebody, I was asked to do an interview about my keyboard part on Brass in Pocket. And I said, sorry, I didn't play keyboards on it. And I told Martin, I said, these guys are nuts. You know, I told one night I was out with Martin Chambers, and he said, yes, you did. He said, what? I played a clavinet part, which was definitely influenced by Mr. McCartney. There's a little thing.
Sure.
You know.
Very
wow.
nice.
Wow.
Well, Chris, this has been a great pleasure.
Sure has. Thank you.
On behalf of our wonderful team and the Queen of All Media, thank you for talking more talk with us.
Thank you. What?